week ago
I was in a forest with the kids.
And I was making a teepee, as you do with kids, you know, making a teepee, and decided to climb a tree, pull down a branch, a dead branch, you know, help with creating the teepee. And I'm up in the tree, and two mountain bikers come by and stop, and they start talking to me up in the tree. He said, "Hey, mister, did you make this path?" And I said, "No." And I thought that might be the end of it, but then they kept chatting. They're like, "Oh, these are amazing paths here in the forest." And I realized that they were engaging me in conversation. I had this awkward moment where I was like, I don't know the protocol for conversations in a tree. Should I get down? I didn't know if it was rude to stay in the tree and chat from there or to get down. And the conversation kept going, and I'm feeling like I got to get out of this tree. But I knew if I jumped from that bottom branch, I was probably going to hit and roll. That didn't seem to be a favorable option. And so I decided to sort of scaffold myself down. It was a very awkward transition getting from the tree down to the ground, continue chatting with these people from a safe distance, of course. But the whole experience got me thinking. I was like, wow, that was a little bit more awkward than I thought. And it got me thinking of the story in the Gospels of Zacchaeus in the tree. And when I got home later that night, I went and I read the story of Zacchaeus up in the tree, the wee little man up in the tree. And it really caught my attention. There's so much there. And so I thought, you know, these days I'm kind of moving and going week by week here. I thought this would be a great story to kind of unpack. Jesus having a conversation with Zacchaeus in a tree. So this is how the story plays out in Luke 19. Says this, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up to him and said, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people who saw this, they began to mutter, "Oh, he's going to be a guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today, salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." I want to unpack this story by starting at the end, because there's something there that I find intriguing, especially with the language that Jesus uses. Jesus has this interaction with Zacchaeus, and it ends with salvation, as Jesus calls it, and Jesus stating that his mission is to save the lost. Of course, the implication in the story being that Zacchaeus was lost, the bigger implication being we too are lost. We too need salvation. And I get that that idea, those words can feel a bit sticky to many of us, because I don't think anyone likes to think of themselves as lost. We might be able to sort of get our heads around the world maybe feels lost, but we don't like to think of ourselves as lost. But Jesus uses that language, and the implication seems to be, well, if no one's lost, there's no need for salvation. So what exactly is Jesus getting at here? What does that mean for you? What does that mean for me? Are we lost? Do we need salvation? What does that even mean? Is there a way to frame that that might help us move beyond this sort of impulsive squirming at this notion of being lost? And I think what I really love about this story, Zacchaeus in the tree, is that it unpacks salvation for me in sort of some jarring and surprising and refreshing ways, especially because I think it challenges for us two notions around how Jesus operates. We call them the Jesus as ticket holder notion and Jesus as moral exemplar. Let me unpack that a little bit. I think in terms of understanding salvation, there's often the temptation to sort of shrink it down to something we can possess or hold on to. For some, salvation gets reduced to this idea of going to heaven when we die. But when thought about this way, salvation can feel like a ticket. Jesus can feel, I think, like one of those people who they kind of feel rather shady, those ticket brokers, I would say, you go to when a show or game is sold out. Back, was it 2015, 16? I can't remember. Back when the Blue Jays were hot, Kristen and I decided to go down. We were going to take in a Blue Jays game for our anniversary, and I was excited about this. I told Kristen, you know what? It's our anniversary. I'm done with sitting in the nosebleeds. Every time I go to a Blue Jays game, I'm up in the 500 levels. I can't see a thing. It's our anniversary. I'm going to get us good tickets. But of course, it was sold out, as those days were when the Jays were hot. So I knew I was going to have to go to one of those ticket broker folk. And I was nervous about this, but I was rather confident. I thought I had some good negotiating skills. And so I was going to try to get us seats in the lower bowl, the lower section there. And so I walk around Sky Dome or whatever it's called these days. And, you know, you got these guys, tickets, who needs their tickets? And I kind of pick out my guy and I approach him and said, yeah, I wouldn't mind a ticket or two. And he's like, what are you looking for? I said, well, you know, wouldn't mind being in the lower level. He's like, what do you want? I got tickets behind the plate, behind the benches. Where do you want to go? And she said, well, how about behind the plate a little bit? He said, sounds good. Two tickets, 12 rows behind the home plate, $250. And I knew this was coming. And so, you know, I tried to put on my best poker face. I was like, ooh, feels a bit steep. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $150 for the deuce. And I was expecting a little haggling. He just turned and walked away from me. And I realized I had obviously gone too low with my bid. He just turned away, started doing his ticket thing again. So I approached him. I said, okay. We can meet halfway in between here. Said, no, the price is $250. I said, well, what about $200? He's like, are you kidding me? I said, listen, I don't even know if this ticket is real. And that really seemed to mess him up. He was not happy with that. He said to me, what do you think I am? You think I'm out here selling tickets every day? I'm going to scam you? Come on, this is my job. I seem to offend him that way. And finally, I tried a few different things, but finally we landed on the price of $250. He got the full thing, bought the tickets, lovely game, had an enjoyable time. But I was sort of stuck in this place. I didn't have what I wanted and needed. He did. And well, I ended up paying the price. He's a ticket broker. And I fear a lot of times when we think about salvation, Jesus can end up feeling like sort of a shady ticket broker. But when we think about this story, salvation isn't a ticket. It's not entrance into something that's non-participatory. It's not something we own or possess. I think you could think about it this way. I own a Canadian passport, and I can put that neatly into my pocket. It's mine. But it would be absurd for me to say that with the passport in my pocket, I have Canada in my pocket as well. And I think when salvation is reduced to something we possess or own or have, it's akin to saying we've got Canada in our pocket. And what's intriguing to me about this story is beyond that, there's absolutely no mention of heaven. There's no mention of afterlife in Zacchaeus' story. There's no indication even that Zacchaeus gets anything. In fact, whatever this salvation thing is, it seems to cost Zacchaeus more than he benefits from it. So to me, this story of salvation doesn't allow that view to work. Salvation's not something you possess. It's not a ticket or a passport. But the story to me also challenges another idea around salvation. Jesus says moral exemplar, I think you could say. I think it can be tempting at times to shrink salvation sort of down to morality. Jesus saves us by showing us how to live a morally good life. Jesus shows us how to love. And if we live into that, if we live that way, we experience salvation. But to me, that sort of, it shrinks Jesus down to a moral example, someone we take directions from, which also feels problematic to me. I text with my brothers every day. We have this ongoing text conversation. And one of the things we like to do is, while we're texting, is we'll throw out everyday occurrences that happen to us and then ask each other how we could have made that more awkward or more interesting. So somebody asks about your lawn. What could you say that would make it more interesting? Somebody, you know, asks you how you're doing, whatever it is, all these little life scenarios, and we just laugh and chuckle at ideas each other have. And one night, my brother Scott had said, "Hey, somebody asked me for directions today. How could we make that more interesting or awkward?" And sort of batting around ideas, and we came up with telling somebody they weren't starting in the right place. So somebody asked you for directions. Well, where you are right now is not a good place to start. And as luck would have it, 2 days later, I'm coming out of Wimpy's on Weber. A red truck pulls up, rolls down the window, and this guy says to me, "Hey, can you help me? I'm looking for Fairview Mall. Do you know how I can get there? Can you give me directions?" And this idea came to mind, and I went with it. I said, "You know, well, right here isn't really a good place to start. What you want to do is you want to go down to the corner of Fairway and Weber and start there. And when you start there, just take a right and you'll be heading right by it. You can't miss it on your right there." And the guy looked at me funny. "Start in the right place." I'm like, yeah, this isn't a good place to start. Start down the road. And away he went. Now, that was really funny to me, made me chuckle in my head. But I was thinking about that guy this week and giving directions to people, because regardless of how I gave directions, think about this guy in the truck. He pulls over because he's lost. Checks in with me, figures out how to get to where he wants to go. Now, besides thinking maybe me a bit strange, chances are he doesn't think about me much after he leaves. He gets directions. He knows where to go now. His need for me is essentially done. I might have given him directions, but it's actually him who does the work of getting himself there. Gets the directions, he's on his way. What does he need me for? And I think this to me is a bit of the problem I sense with thinking of Jesus as like a moral example. Jesus becomes a directions guy. He points us in the right direction, but after we have directions, well, there isn't really need for him anymore. Just follow them and you'll be fine. Follow the directions, you'll be fine. In this way, salvation to me sort of, it's actually on us. We can get directions, but then we do the work of it. Jesus is reduced to simply pointing us in the right direction. But what intrigues me particularly about this story with Zacchaeus is that's entirely absent. Notice in this story with Zacchaeus, Jesus doesn't give any moral instructions to Zacchaeus at all. It's entirely not there. So it doesn't seem to make sense of the salvation we see play out in this story. So how does salvation play out? How does salvation play out in the story of Zacchaeus? Well, the way it plays out really intrigues me. The interaction unfolds with Jesus making a request of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus responds. Then he does some generous things, and it ends with Jesus declaring salvation has come for Zacchaeus. And I think there's something really telling here about salvation, how we think of it. I mean, notice how the interaction begins. It starts here. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up at him and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. I mean, this kind of cracks me up because it's a rather bold request on Jesus' part. Normally, when we host someone, we're the ones who do the inviting. So I might say to you, hey, why don't you come over for dinner on Friday night? And the reason we do that is it gives us time to prepare. I can clean the house. I can think of a suitable dinner option. But imagine me being like, hey, can I come and eat at your house? And you know what? Why don't I just follow you home right now? It would sort of jar some of us. There's no time to prepare. There's no time to tidy your place. In fact, there's no time to even think about dinner. I mean, if you only have Kraft dinner in the house, I guess that's what your guest would be eating. And the immediacy of Jesus' request sort of exposes Zacchaeus. Jesus asking him to enter his life, his house as is. No glossing over, no tidying up. It's like Jesus wants into the mess. And Zacchaeus' response is really, really pointed. He welcomes him gladly. Before salvation is announced, before Zacchaeus will do any of his good deeds, there's the welcome of Jesus. You're welcome into me, into my home as it is. Not as I'd like you to see it, but as is. I think there's the key for me. Rather than seeing Jesus as ticket holder or passport office, rather than seeing Jesus as a direction guy, I think salvation means seeing Jesus as guest, who's sort of always extending the invitation, always asking to stay with us. Every day, you could say every hour, the ask is there. Hey, I want to stay with you. I want to be your guest. Here's how I've come to think of it lately. I don't know about you all, but I've been doing a lot of like Zoom meetings, Google Hangout meetings, right? And these are just, wow, it can be a bit much sometimes. In fact, I was Kristen with her work. She's been doing a lot of these Zoom meetings, and the person, her boss, that vice principal or something, who runs the Zoom meetings every week for the staff, he's introduced a laugh track for himself. So every time he says something he thinks funny, he hits the laugh track, and you know, it's just one of these ways he's trying to, I don't think it's working well, but one of the ways he's trying to spruce up these meetings. But I've been thinking about these meetings, how, you know, everybody's talking over each other, and I sort of thought about my mind as a Zoom meeting. There's a lot of Brads in there voicing their opinion. And there's a lot of usual characters. I mean, there's always Nap Guy Brad. Every time my head's in a meeting, there's always Nap Guy Brad who's, you know, hey, I'd like to put on the agenda, I think we should take a nap today. It's like, we don't have time for that. What are you talking about? But that's always his go-to thing. Of course, there's Sex Guy Brad, right? I'm cooking or something, and he's like, should we be thinking about sex? I'm like, no, I'm cooking right now. But that voice is always there, sort of in my head, trying to put that on the agenda. There's Distraction Guy Brad, you know, always going, you know what, this meeting needs a break. Let's go on social media for 3 hours, or maybe we should check the fridge. Maybe there's some pickles in there we can eat. There's Mean Brad. This guy's always just his voice. This meeting sucks. We're all a bunch of losers. He's always calling me names. Dreamer Brad is always there. This guy, I'm so sick of him already. He's always got big ideas. He's had big ideas with COVID-19, like stuck in isolation. And that guy in my head's like, you know what? We should build a treehouse for the kids. And I've never built anything in my entire life, but suddenly that idea comes to mind. I'm like, interesting. Or I was thinking the other day about keeping bees. Maybe I should be a beekeeper, get a hive going on my roof or something. I'm like, where's Dreamer Brad coming from? I've never done, none of that stuff would work. And so all these voices going, COVID-19, Brad, this guy, he's the newest member of the staff in my head, I suppose you could say. He's a bit skittish. One day he's like, we're fine. We're all going to be good. Next day, I'm thinking about buying canned tuna in bulk. All these voices sort of clattering in my head, trying to get attention, trying to get on the agenda. I've sort of thought about Jesus' invitation here in terms of Zoom meeting or a Google Hangout meeting. Because I think what happens is for Zacchaeus, it all starts with him welcoming Jesus into his home as guest. And I think that's key to understanding the beginning of salvation, to welcome Jesus, I think you could say, into the conference call of our heads. Allowing Jesus into that conversation, allowing Jesus to have a say, a prominent one even. It is in welcoming Jesus as guest into our lives that we begin to learn and live a new way of life by following Jesus' path. And to me, that's how we enter the expansive trail, you could say, that is Jesus' salvation. It's not something we own. It's not a ticket. It's not directions. It's not following some good ancient moral advice. It's welcoming Jesus into our lives and in that finding a life you enter and live into. And notice in the story what happens the moment Zacchaeus welcomes Jesus. I mean, stuff starts happening rather quickly. I think when that happens to us, we learn of God's, in Dallas Willard's words, God's divine conspiracy is to make the world right, to restore what is broken. And what we learn is we're called to participate in that. And so to welcome Jesus is to enter the vast expanse of salvation where all things broken are being repaired or put back together. I mean, this is what happens to Zacchaeus, right, in the story. He welcomes Jesus. Then Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." I mean, this is captivating. When you pick it apart, what Zacchaeus seems to realize in welcoming Jesus is two things. First, by virtue of his privilege and wealth, he has involuntarily contributed to the brokenness of the world. But now he's entered the realm of salvation and realizes something needs to be done about that. And beyond that, he realizes that he has made some voluntary choices. There's been some actions on his part that have caused harm to others. He's actively contributed to the brokenness of the world, perhaps by cheating some of what is theirs. But now in the realm of salvation, he commits to doing something about that. What Zacchaeus encounters, I think, is what the Christian tradition would call his own sin, which I get is another one of those words that sort of makes some of us want to squirm. We've heard that word thrown around a little too often. But I like how James Martin, Catholic priest, great writer, he describes sin this way. He says this: sin is not where people are weak but are trying, but where people are strong and not bothering. For Jesus, sin is a failure to bother to love. I think you could say sin is quite simply those ways we don't even bother trying to love. And by doing that, it contributes to the pain and hurt and brokenness of the world. And so sin is to acknowledge we have disrupted shalom. I know another word I'm throwing around, another fancy word, simply means we've disrupted God's plan to put everything back in its right place. I think it's this idea that all around us are broken pieces of life. How we relate to God feels broken and strained, right? And we know and feel the weight of how our relationships with others are broken, or we feel the world groan because of our broken relationship with the planet. And internally, we, of course, we know how we think and feel about ourselves oftentimes feels broken. I think the idea of shalom is putting those broken pieces back together. And so to enter the path of salvation is to simply, as Richard Beck says, find two broken pieces in life and put them back together again. What does that mean or look like? Well, I think, again, it's about living in such a way that we recognize that the world feels broken. It's shattered into a million tiny little pieces in ways both big and small, ways we voluntarily or involuntarily contributed to that. And these pieces, these shards of broken pieces in the world, they scrape against each other. I mean, whenever we fight or hurt someone, whenever we litter or pollute or participate in things that make rainforests disappear or animals go extinct, whenever it feels like the world is warring against us, right? Whether it be natural disasters or this virus we're all fighting at the moment, or whenever it feels like we're against God or that God is somehow against us. And of course, within ourselves, whenever we feel broken, whether it's a guilty conscience or feeling that I'm a bad person or a failure in life, that's all of these sharp pieces cutting against each other. That's what sin is those shards rubbing against one another. And so to enter the path of salvation, in my mind, is trying to put those pieces back together again. I used to live out by Chicopee, out by where the new bridge, I guess it's not that new, but used to live out there. And every morning there was this guy. He must have been in his 80s. Every morning he would run and jog. He'd have his sweatpants on. He had this reflective vest on, a headband. But in the other hand, he had a garbage bag. Every single morning, this old guy running with his garbage bag. And as he would run, whenever he saw a piece of litter, he would stop, pick it up, put it in the trash. That is salvation. When you or I befriend someone who normally doesn't get attention, two pieces back together, that's salvation. All the small acts of kindness I see and hear people doing during this COVID crisis, that's salvation. When you can trust God instead of being angry or resentful at God, that is salvation. When you can forgive the person that hurt you and put those pieces back together, that's salvation. When you can forgive yourself, that's salvation. Salvation isn't about going to heaven when we die. It's not about living a morally upright life. It's about finding two broken pieces, two shards, wherever they are around us, wherever we find them, putting them back together again. That's salvation. And this is exactly what Zacchaeus does. And he starts with the most obvious to him, the most direct shards around him. It's like, okay, I have it pretty good, Zacchaeus is thinking, and I see others don't. So I'll be generous. And Jesus says, today, salvation has come to this house. And then Zacchaeus thinks, you know what? I think I've cheated people. I think I've wronged people. So he picks up that piece and says, I'll give back four times whatever I've cheated people from. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. And so by welcoming Jesus and by putting broken pieces back together again, he enters the realm of salvation. And I think there's a challenge there for us. I mean, all around us are shards of brokenness, painful pieces inside ourselves, in our world, in our relationships. And today we can start with just one, taking what is broken, working to piece it back together again. And when we do, salvation has come. You know, when we see salvation as this expansive path you enter and follow, then rather than something that we own, like a ticket or some moral advice we follow on, to me, it's been like a profound switch for me. And let me tell you what I mean by returning to the idea of paths and passports. I mean, imagine I said to you, hey, can I walk the Bruce Trail by hiking in and around Hamilton? I can imagine you responding to me, well, a little bit. Or imagine you've got a friend who wants to move to Canada. They recently got a Canadian passport. They want to see Canada. So imagine they say to you, hey, can I see Canada by going to St. John's, Newfoundland? We would say, well, a little bit. What if I go to Vancouver? Sure, a little bit. Calgary? Yeah, a little bit. Quebec City? Sure, a little bit. You can't own or put Canada in your pocket. You can't say you've seen Canada by visiting certain parts of it. I mean, it's too vast to be fully seen. I think it's the same way with salvation. Salvation is like entering God's country. It's this vast, expansive path or trail where Jesus is welcomed, the work of putting broken pieces of life back together again. It's a country where that happens. And again, it's not a terrain we can own or achieve or complete. It's a path, a terrain we enter into. And I think you can apply that a little bit towards faith. You could say, can I be saved by trusting Jesus in my heart? Yeah, a little bit. Well, can I get salvation by being involved in a local church? Yeah, a little bit. What if I get baptized? Sure, a little bit. Can I be saved if I'm working for the environment? Yes, a little bit. What if I work for restorative justice? A little bit. Can I be saved if I'm really generous with my money? Yes, a little bit. Can I be saved if I'm befriending marginalized groups or, you know, making sure that I pay attention and befriend people who are on the margins? Yes, a little bit. Salvation's bigger than doing this or that. Sort of carry the metaphor. It's about starting on the Christian path and realizing it takes you into this vast terrain where moment by moment we can taste and experience and know and work for salvation all a little bit at a time. I mean, this is why I'm very, I don't know why of all things, I've told you this before, but I'm very intent with my kids to tell them that heaven is 3 feet away and invisible. And I do that because I want them to know that it's never far from us. Shalom is never far from us. Salvation is never far from us. When we welcome Jesus, try to find broken pieces to put back together, it's right there. But you can't own it. You can't achieve it. You can't accomplish it. Think about it this way, especially for you wine lovers out there. Imagine I said to you, hey, I want to taste the essence of Niagara wine in one bottle. What bottle of wine can I buy that captures Niagara in a bottle? I want to taste that and have it and own it. And my guess is my wine friends on here would sort of laugh at me, right? Like, I mean, it's a sort of absurd proposition. You can't capture Niagara wine in one bottle. There's varieties of wine, varieties of producing, soil composition, climate, philosophies, not to mention different years. You can't taste all of Niagara in one bottle. All you can do is have a little. You can't taste it all, but you can taste a little bit. And that's the key, because on the Christian path, the idea is that the fullness and completion of salvation is not available to us. It will only come when Jesus' kingdom and reign fully come. That will happen sort of in Lord of the Rings language with the return of the king. And the hope of the Christian path, when the resurrected one completes the cosmic work of resurrection, only then will we know salvation in its entirety, when the earth and environment and ourselves and our relationships and all of humanity and the cosmos are made new. Then and only then will we know salvation in every aspect. In the meantime, we enter the path. We enter the terrain of salvation. And how? Well, Zacchaeus' story seems to be this: welcome Jesus. What does that mean practically? I've told you before, I don't know if you can see my hands, they're raw from washing my hands, but I've had this little thing I do when I wash my hands. I say the Lord's Prayer, and to me, That is my way of starting the day or reorienting my day to welcome Jesus in. So when I'm washing my hands, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Little way to say you're welcome here in the vast terrain of my crazy Zoom meeting head. You're welcome here. Welcome Jesus. And then second, finding broken pieces and putting them back together. And they're everywhere. For some of us, it could be, hey, we said that thing to our partner or kid, and maybe it simply starts with picking up those pieces and saying, you know what, I'm sorry. Or maybe it's all those small acts of kindness, delivering things to people, whatever it is. When we have eyes to see, we realize all around us are these broken fragments and shards and pieces of life. And one at a time, we pick them up and try to put them back together. This morning, I want to close with a video prayer that Murray sent me this week. And I think it's beautiful. It reorients ourselves again around this COVID-19 crisis, but I also think it speaks to all the small little ways we can pick up two pieces and put them back together.